Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The COP28 debate over fossil fuels heats up.
And that is why at COP28, we need a strong commitment to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal, not just unabated fossil fuels, but all fossil fuels, including oil, gas, and coal.
A UN official says the world is indebted to Africa when it comes to financing climate change. Nigeria's president orders an investigation into an apparent accidental bombing and killing of civilians. Nigerian press advocates hail ECOWAS court ruling on media laws. Rescue work continues in Tanzania following devastating floods and landslides in the town of Katesh.
So far, the total number of people that were injured was 117. And the number of the dead so far is 65.
And the U.S. imposes visa bans on extremist West Bank settlers. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The COP28 Climate Summit in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, is getting heated as leaders debate how to rein in global warming amid accusations that the hosts have invited a record number of lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry. Henry Richwell reports.
Some 70,000 delegates are attending the United Nations COP28 Climate Change Conference. Politicians, scientists, campaigners, advocating a myriad array of interests and ideas. But the focus appears to be narrowing on a key question. Do we need to ban fossil fuels outright? Coal, oil and gas are blamed for much of global warming, but are also the driving force behind many economies, including that of summit host United Arab Emirates. The latest figures show 2023 is expected to be a record-breaking year for global carbon dioxide emissions.
The growing emissions year on year are responsible for climate change. And as long as they're not brought down to zero, then the warming is going to continue.
Research from a coalition of environmental groups suggests more than 2,400 delegates at COP28 are connected to fossil fuel industries.
This is 7 times larger than Indigenous Peoples' delegation and a four times increase from last year's 636 delegates who are lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry.
Scientists say greenhouse gas emissions need to be slashed by 43% over the next 6 years. But current trajectories suggest emissions will actually rise by 9% over that same time span.
And that is why at COP28, we need a strong commitment to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal, not just unabated fossil fuels, but all fossil fuels, including oil, gas, and coal.
Others say that's unrealistic, and fossil fuels will have to be part of the energy mix, alongside innovations like carbon markets and carbon capture. Current COP28 President Sultan Al Jaber is also head of the United Arab Emirates state-run oil company, which plans to increase production substantially by 2030. He wants a phasing down of fossil fuels rather than a phasing out, insisting that this is the only way to rein in global warming while allowing for development. Facing a barrage of criticism, the COP president defended his stance Tuesday.
I am quite surprised with the constant and repeated attempts to undermine the work of the COP28 presidency.
That has done little to placate his critics.
We cannot play games designed to protect the obscene profits of these oil and gas petrostates.
COP28 has got off to a heated start. Observers say the hosts face a tough challenge to oversee negotiations towards a final declaration, with the spotlight so firmly fixed on the summit president himself. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
The Africa Director of the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, says she believes the world is indebted to Africa when it comes to financing climate change. The UN Climate Change Conference, also known as COP28, is taking place in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, from November 30 until December 12. The United States has pledged $3 billion to Green Climate Fund. UNDP Africa Director Ahona Ezeakonwa says the biggest polluters are also the richest countries of the world. Yet, Africa, which contributes very little to climate change, is one of the regions impacted the most. She explains to me some of the challenges facing Africa as it tries to balance development and climate change.
The first one I see is finance. The fiscal situation on the continent is quite sobering because you have countries still struggling to recover from the impact of COVID. You know, COVID set countries back many years in terms of their development trajectory. As they were trying to deal with that, the war in Ukraine happened, creating a huge global cost of living crisis with imported inflation, but also high interest rates that made borrowing from the global market extremely expensive for countries. And then, of course, we still have the impact of climate, you know, with extreme weather conditions causing disasters that countries then have to put up resources to deal with. So you've got poverty. In Africa, actually, we have figures that show that 50 million more people fell back into poverty. So dealing with that condition of just being able to provide services, the basic minimum services to the population that's facing a cost of living crisis, and at the same time balancing that with investing in a carbon-free world, whether it's in the energy sector or in the food system sector or in the health sector, that is a monumental challenge for countries.
So finance is very crucial. What is this loss and damage fund? How does it relate to the $3 billion that the U.S. has pledged to Green Climate Fund?
Right. So as you know, Africa contributes almost insignificant numbers to the emission reality that we're seeing, less than 4%. But Africa is bearing the brunt of the pollution of the world with all the disasters that the countries on the continent are facing, whether you are a landlocked country, a small island developing state, or a country in the Sahel region. All of these countries are seeing a devastating impact of climate change that is affecting lives and livelihoods. So you have to respond to that. And we could call this, let's say, a humanitarian response, emergency response, where if Mozambique has a cyclone tomorrow and houses are damaged or completely destroyed, you have to rebuild those houses. You have to build back better, as they say. You have to rebuild schools, roads, infrastructure. All of that require resources, billions of dollars. Loss and damage fund should go towards supporting countries to pick up the pieces, basically. Whereas the other fund, the climate fund, is really more developmental in nature. It is looking at investments that contribute to both mitigation and adaptation. And, you know, the more investment you have in that fund, perhaps the less you have to invest in loss and damage. So our message really is that you shouldn't rob Peter to pay Paul, so to speak. You have to make sure that both funds are robustly serviced so that we're able to tackle this from both ends, the prevention, the mitigation, the adaptation, which all contribute to reducing the losses and the damage. And that's what the GCF fund is intended for.
So as you mentioned, Africa is one of the regions of the world that is most affected when it comes to climate change. So when we talk about financing climate change, what does Africa contribute, or does it need help from the international community to finance climate change in Africa?
Well, I think if we're speaking truth, we could basically say that Africa is owed a climate debt, because as I say, the heavy polluters are also the richest countries, right? 80% of the wealth is coming out of these countries that pollute the most. So some of those resources have to be unlocked for adaptation on the continent. But also African countries have shown leadership in contributing to a decarbonized world and greener pathways to development. And fair to say that this continent is probably the only one in the world today that has the chance to have a completely green industrial revolution. So it behoves really rich countries to provide the adequate amount of resources, financial, technology, capacity, and otherwise that allows Africa to follow a greener pathway to industrialization.
Ahona Ezeakonwa is the Africa Director of the United Nations Development Programme. She was speaking with me from Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Rescue work was continuing yesterday in Tanzania following floods and landslides in the town of Katesh, about 478 miles from the capital Dar es Salaam. President Samia Suluhu Hassan cut short her trip in Dubai, where she has been attending the COP28 climate conference. Mombare Matienini is the Tanzanian government spokesperson. He tells me that 65 bodies have been recovered so far and 1,150 homes were destroyed.
The rescue is still ongoing. So far, the total number of people that were injured was 117, and the number of the dead so far is 65. Adults 41 and children 24. 60 bodies have already been collected for burial and 5 bodies not yet identified, and we're expecting the chief government chemist is probably going to undertake a DNA test to determine the family members of those 5 people who could bodies who could not be identified. The camp that we are having right now for survivors has a total of 190, and the government is taking care of everything, food, shelter for these people, and medical treatment that we need. So far, those are the numbers. But actually, a total of 1,150 families have lost their residency, and that's a total of 5,600 people in a small town of Kateshi and the surrounding villages, about 8 of them.
Is this the rainy season in Tanzania? In other words, is this place, this region, is it prone to floods?
It's now a rain season, but most importantly that in September, the public was notified by the authority that El Nino is going to start in the first week of October all the way to the first week of January. And it's covering almost all parts of the country, including this part. But this part is not prone to floods. And what has happened actually, technically cannot be categorized as flood. Because what happened in the mountain range here, that's where you have soft rocks. With a heavy rainfall, those soft rocks absorbed a large amount of water. And eventually, we had a kind of a mudslide or landslide. And it came down, washed away a village and some other parts along the way. Otherwise, it's normally a normal way for water coming down from the mount all the way to the village. And on that day, unfortunately, in the early morning of the 3rd of December, it turned out to be something else. That mudslide also took away some trees and rocks and everything, and basically washed away part of a village called Gendabi.
So President Samia Suluhu Hassan has cut short her trip to the COP28. Nationally now, what is the government doing?
The government actually, we have about 10 ministers there, and they are under the coordination of a minister who is responsible for that under the Prime Minister's office. We also have the Technical Committee of the National Disaster. We also have members of our security and defense forces working hard with the people who are there and some other volunteers to rescue whatever is possible. The government has sent equipment, and we are still expecting to receive more. There is an emergency camp for survivors. The president has ordered that the government pay for the funeral of all those victims of the disaster. The government is also taking care of the cost of those who have been hospitalized. We are expecting the visit of our president on the 7th of December.
Mumbare Matini is the spokesperson for the Tanzanian government. He was speaking with us from the town of Katesh in the Hanang district of Manyara region. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 6th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Nigerian President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has ordered an investigation into an apparent accidental bombing of a community in Kaduna State by the army. About 85 people were said to have been killed and 66 injured, including women and children. According to the Nigerian Daily Post newspaper, the president described the bombing as very unfortunate. Kabiru Mato is a professor of political science at the University of Abuja. He tells me there have been investigations in the past, but he's not sure if any report has been made.
Well, the military said actually it was signal of intelligence. They were briefed that the insurgents or the terrorists were moving in group around that area. So they set up the drones and unfortunately released the bombs. But, you know, instead of attacking the bandits, the bomb ended up attacking a religious group that was celebrating.
We understand President Tinubu has called for an investigation.
Obviously, James, this is not the first time that we're having this type of, episode in Nigeria. This is about the third or the fourth time that the military will either using aircraft or this or drones, prepared to attack insurgents or terrorists or bandits. But unfortunately, the attack will end up hitting, the population. The civilians have been, victims of these in Borno State, in Nasarawa State, and the Sanabin in Taraba State. So this is not the first time. And anytime this type of events, catastrophe happens, the government will come out with promises of investigation. I'm not aware that, there's any report that has been made public and perhaps giving very lucid explanation as to either there are elements of carelessness or strictly, they were accidental. So even in this case, I doubt if it's going to be any different.
This is a military mistake. And what does that say about the fight now against Boko Haram?
Unfortunately, it's a cult of series of mistakes that we always get. And, those of us that are here, in Nigeria, aware of the fact that the communities have often complained that they give very credible intelligence reports to security officers as to the whereabouts of terrorists and bandits across the northern part of this country. Unfortunately, in most cases, these security agencies do not attack that material time due to the bureaucracies of, the military are wanting to get clearance at one level or the other. So at the end of the day, the intelligence that are given by the civil population and the general public went down the drain. And, intermittently and at times like this, the military using all intelligence often backfires and put the society into this kind of mess that we are in now. So, it's an accident that's happening too much. It's an accident that really questions the strategic expertise of perhaps the Nigerian military authorities and the technocracy itself.
Kabiru Mato is the professor of political science at the University of Abuja. He was speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Nigerian press freedom advocates are praising a recent ruling from the Court of West African Bloc, ECOWAS, that ordered Nigerian authorities to review sections of the country's Press Act. The court said portions of the law discriminate against online and non-professional journalists. The ruling followed a suit filed by two Nigerian journalists against authorities in 2021. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian journalists Isaac Olamikon and Edohoho Uberiese approached the ECOWAS regional court 2 years ago after security operatives arrested the duo in separate incidents while gathering the news. Olamikon was accused of practicing with an expired media license, while Uberese, a citizen journalist who often covers happenings in her local community in southern Nigeria's Edo State, was told by authorities that she was not qualified to tell stories or carry out investigations. But the three-member panel of the ECOWAS court ruled that three sections of the Nigerian Press Council Act imposed age restrictions and educational qualifications for journalists and therefore discriminated against online and citizen journalists. The court said technological advancements meant the media space is also evolving, but that Nigerian law failed to accommodate such changes. Ahaziah Abubakar, a former director of news at Voice of Nigeria, says the ECOWAS ruling couldn't come at a better time.
I'm excited that the court has ruled. At least a court of competent jurisdiction has ruled on a thing like that. Journalists have become endangered species. I hope, my prayer is not just ruling on it.
Journalism advocacy group Reporters Without Borders says Nigeria is one of West Africa's most dangerous and difficult countries for journalists, who are often monitored, attacked, and arbitrarily arrested. The group says the Nigerian constitution protects freedom of expression, but there are many laws with provisions that make it possible to obstruct journalism. In its defense at the ECOWAS court, the Nigerian government said the rights to information and freedom of expression are not absolute and that the arrest of the journalist was in the interest of national security. Abubakar says he is a little worried about the implementation of the ECOWAS verdict.
Implementation will be difficult. You and I know that so many court pronouncements in Nigeria, the powers that be, obey court orders. Implementation is selective as it suits the powers that be. And therefore, I am not too confident that the implementation of the court ruling.
President Aigbokan is the legal counsel to the Nigerian journalists.
Honorary governments will be recalcitrant. So I think civil society group should take it off from there. We're top part of it. So they'll take it off from there. There will be more public engagement on how that law cannot stand. But as it is now, the sections of those laws have already been struck down, whether or not it is amended nationally or not.
It's not clear when or if Nigerian authorities will amend the law, but media advocates will be watching to ensure no journalist is punished under the law again. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The United States is imposing a visa ban on Israeli settlers engaged in West Bank violence against Palestinians. We get the details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
The State Department announced on Tuesday that it is beginning to impose travel bans on dozens of extremist Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank who have been implicated in a series of recent attacks. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller says the action is coming now because the Israeli government has not taken sufficient action to rein in such violence, which escalated after the Hamas terrorist group attacked Israeli citizens on October 7th.
We have made clear we think that when the facts support it, people should be prosecuted if they've committed acts of violence. And so we've taken the actions that we, the United States government, can take. That does not obviate the need for the government of Israel to take its own actions, and we will continue to be clear with them about it.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement said the United States will continue to hold settlers responsible for violence against Palestinians, as well as Palestinian attacks against Israelis, particularly at a time when tensions are high due to the war between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.